What is space travel really like? It's the question Chris Jones explores in his book Too Far From Home. It's partly the story of the space shuttle Columbia that exploded in 2003, and partly a study of just how dangerous space travel actually is.
It's crazy when you actually break it down. I'm not particularly a space guy, or at least I wasn't before I started working on the book. And if someone asked me before if I want to go to space, I would have said sure. If you ask me now, I would say hell no, because the shuttle is this, you know, it's millions of parts. It's made by thousands of people. If any one of those parts or if any one of those people is messed up somewhere along the way, then there's a good chance that seven people are going to die in fire and smoke. And that's just the reality of it. You know, every time people are launched into space, in some ways, it's this minor miracle. And, you know, the space station's only about 250 miles above us. Dallas and Houston are farther apart, but it is quite a divide. It's this chasm, yeah. And to string people across is a pretty tough job.
NASA has made us feel as though space travel can be safe. You start to think about the shuttle, though, and we now know that it can be dangerous. You went through this. I mean, can you tell me about the things that can go wrong with a shuttle?
The list would be, I mean, would fill a phone book. You know, for me, one of the great telling little details about how fragile this machine is. Down in Florida, there are little hardware store owls guarding the space shuttle from woodpeckers because woodpeckers have put holes in the external tank before. You know, this is this massive, massive machine that can be brought down by a bird with a pointy beak. It can be brought down if it's cold outside. You know, just a few weeks ago, we realized that if hailstones bang into it, that's a big problem. We've learned, you know, from Challenger that something as simple as an O-ring on a solid rocket booster can take it down. There's this, in some ways, this eternal list of problems.
Somewhere in the book you describe it as a gas tank with a riding module on it or something like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that we sort of forget is that it's 85% propellant. Your car is 5% propellant. A fighter jet is 35% propellant. The shuttle is 85% gas. And then we light it on fire. In some ways, it's insanity physics. I mean, the other sort of myth is that astronauts are these incredibly, well, and they are incredibly brave, don't get me wrong, but they're not immune to nerves or fear. They're in the cockpit for several hours before launch. And in those moments, they're sweat. You know, one of my favorite stories was a veteran astronaut named Story Musgrave was sitting very quietly in the cockpit while his younger colleagues were chuckling and idle chatter to fill the time. And someone said, Story, you know, why are you so quiet? And he said, because I'm scared to death. And everyone else just suddenly shut up and went, holy moly, this is a big deal. These aren't guys with cowboy hats going yippee-ki-yay. I mean, they're stressing for those final few moments.
Yeah, and they're smart guys. They really are the kind of people who know what can go wrong. Well, I mean, one of the other things that sort of astonished me was thinking about the spacesuits. We think that when they go on a spacewalk, they're linked to the station, and if they were to lose the link, if the tether were to go, that they'd be okay. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? I mean, they could be floating in space forever.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the closest anyone has come to that was a Russian mission, actually, where one guy was floating outside the capsule and the other guy was supposed to stay inside and sort of keep watch. But there's this thing, this phenomenon, you know, they used to call it the call of the waters, where sailors would, for no apparent reason, pitch themselves off the backs of their ships and into the ocean. And the same thing happens in space. And this guy who was inside the capsule decided, oh, I'm just going to poke my head out for a look, and was soon adrift. And because he was never supposed to be out there, he had no tether or anything like that. And only at the last second did his colleague sort of grab his foot as he was floating on by. And without that grab, he was done. He was a satellite. And that can still happen today. They do have these sort of nitrogen backpacks that if everything goes right, they can slam themselves back into station. But if they miss station, or if the nitrogen doesn't fire, or some other calamity happens, you know, these guys might have as long as 7 hours before their oxygen runs out, where they can sort of confront their goodbyes.
It tells you an awful lot about who it is and what they're doing. These are the little things that sort of paint the picture. We've seen some of the bigger things, and I gather you have too. I mean, you examined the tragedy of the space shuttle Columbia in 2003. Maybe, I'm not sure we all remember. What was the mission?
It was the last scheduled purely scientific mission for shuttle. Every other shuttle launch, and this is still the case today, is going to space station to bring something to space station, a part or to add a module. Columbia was science. And in fact, that launch had been bumped several times in favor of missions that were considered more important. So these seven people, who ultimately were lost, had repeatedly been bumped to the back of the line. And when they finally launched, I imagine for them it was sort of this vindication, and little did they know that not long later they would lose their lives for it.
Well, they did accomplish everything they set out to accomplish, and then they turned around to come home, and and it exploded. What happened?
Well, at launch, a piece of foam, there's sort of this insulating foam on the external tank. This foam had come off during most launches and had bounced harmlessly off the shuttle. And in this particular instance, it had happened to hit a very small panel on the front of the left wing, the leading edge of the left wing, and put a hole into it. And there were suspicions that this impact had occurred, but the wisdom on the ground was that the foam was never powerful enough to knock a hole into it. But as it turns out, in this particular instance, it was. It was total fluke, very bad luck that this particular shuttle had this particular spot hit by this particular chunk of foam. A lot had to happen for this to happen. But that left an opening. And the heat of reentry, I don't know if you can picture it in your mind, but you see the shuttle returning and it's surrounded by fire. Well, that fire got through that hole and started to melt the internal structure of the shuttle from the inside out. And it kind of collapsed in on itself.
I think a lot of people remember seeing that fire, and it grew in the way that we expected it to. And then all of a sudden it was much more than that.
Yeah, all of a sudden, you know, instead of one streak across the sky, there were several. And it wasn't that long after before parts of Columbia started raining down, and we saw those horrific images of an astronaut's helmet lying on the grass or a piece of the engine block falling into a golf course.
Of course, the other thing that happens is that those are the images that are left in our mind, and we've all, I think, forgotten that there were three astronauts still in space. But the thing that is astonishing when you think about it is that they didn't have any way home. There wasn't another shuttle to go get them. We always think that somehow, you know, in the Heinlein novels, there's always another rocket ship out there that can come pick you up. But that's not the stage we're in space travel, is it?
No, there are only so many ways. There's the shuttle. And initially, there was the idea that we could send another shuttle up to get them. And then when the problem of the foam sort of surfaced and NASA realized how many bullets they had dodged, you know, over the history of the program, and that there was a recognition that if they lost another shuttle, if they lost a third out of five, that NASA would probably get its plug pulled. You know, the idea of just sending up another shuttle was scrapped pretty quickly.
Then on the other hand, you've got three guys up there and you got to go get them. I mean, you can't let them just sit there until the air runs out.
Well, except that the idea was that we will have them sit there. they called them up and said, guys, you might be up there for a year, maybe 2 years. And these are guys with wives and children and lives on Earth. Again, it was part of that moment. They lose Columbia, they lose their seven friends, and there's a sadness from that. But very shortly thereafter, there was that, how are we going to get home? The only other option is this antiquated Russian rocket called the Soyuz, which NASA was very reluctant to use, apart from reasons of pride. It's this old, messy piece of technology. But finally, they did come to the understanding that we can't leave these guys up here. All of a sudden, these guys found themselves strapping into a Soyuz capsule and pressing a button that sent them on their way back to Earth.
Wow. You know, after all this, they're still talking about other space missions. There are people who are talking about going to Mars, which is an extended space mission for people. What kind of obstacles do they face in contemplating a thing like that?
For someone like me, the fascinating thing are the human limits that they'll confront. I mean, there are people who obsess about the machines, the propulsion systems, or how will we land on the surface of Mars? How will we get back off the surface of Mars? And those are all fascinating. But for me, you know, the questions are, what kind of people will want to go away for 2 years? What kind of people will want to live on another planet? You know, the astronauts go through this rigorous physical testing, and they are elite machines as human beings in a lot of ways. There's a little over 100 of them. Only 25 of them are qualified to go on a long-duration mission because something very simple in their medical background, a heart murmur when they're pushed to 95% capacity, will scratch them from that list. Because your body undergoes changes. Your muscles atrophy. The muscles that we use to get out of bed in the morning or to climb into our cars, they're not using. Your bones start to decay. You can start getting things like kidney stones and calcium deposits. Your spine lengthens as much as an inch, so you can get back aches and so on. Your sinuses are filled with fluid because gravity isn't drawing them down. You know, there's this list of ways that weightlessness affect our bodies, because our bodies were designed for gravity. But then there are the psychological issues, and the longer these people spend up there, the more we learn how to keep them content. And in some ways, their assignment is learn how to be happy. What is it that makes you happy up there?
What have they discovered so far? I mean, what does make them happy?
It can be very mundane things in some ways. You know, they decided that the idea of having dinner sitting down at a table is important. It makes you less homesick. So they have a table where you can sit down, you strap yourself down, and you're sitting like you do on Earth. Music is very important. There's a supply of music up there. There's stereos and headphones, little connections to life on Earth. There's email, there's internet, there's a satellite phone, there's video conferences. Those are all very important. And then it's like weird little material things. There's a guitar up there. There's a Casio keyboard up there. There's a football up there. There's all these things that sort of help people feel more at home, even though they're floating in this tin can in the middle of this abyss.
Chris Jones is a writer for Esquire magazine. His book is called Too Far From Home.